KQED.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org. URS, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical support to public agencies and private companies. URS.com. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, shocking, stunning, unbelievable. Some of the words being used to describe the FBI charges against State Senator Leland Yee. What's the fallout from a third major scandal to rock the state capitol?
One is an anomaly, two is a coincidence, three?
Also, she was the first woman to head UC San Francisco. Outgoing Chancellor Susan Desmond-Hellman talks about the challenge of going from a private drug company to running a public institution. Plus, what to do at a state park known for its wildflowers when the drought means that wildflowers are scarce.
We love the folks we get when times are tougher because they're not just out for like momentary eye candy and then back to LA or wherever.
It's the California Report. Well, there's nothing new or especially shocking about corruption in politics, but FBI charges this week against State Senator Leland Yee of San Francisco took things to a whole new level. None of it's been proved, of course, yet, but the allegations are that Yee hooked up with a notorious gangster from San Francisco's Chinatown, Raymond Shrimp Boy Chow, taking campaign cash from undercover FBI agents in exchange for political favors, while also conspiring to traffic in weapons, including shoulder-fired rockets and assault rifles. Well, Friday morning, the state legislature voted to suspend Yee and two other Democratic senators mired in legal troubles, Ronald Calderon and Roderick Wright, both from Southern California. Joining us now to help put it all in perspective, our Sacramento Bureau Chief Scott Detrow and Daniel Newman, president and co-founder of MapLight. That's a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that tracks the influence of money in politics. And Scott, let me begin with you. Describe the debate Friday morning, if you would, in the state Senate.
It was relatively straightforward. When you're talking about allegations of bribery and potential gun running, there's a really bipartisan consensus that the allegations here are outrageous and something needs to be done about them. The divide here between Democrats and some Republicans was the degree of which to answer to this. Yee is now the third different state senator who's facing legal problems within the last few months. But Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg acknowledged that the nature of the charges against Yee take things up to a whole new level here.
I know of no ethics class that teaches about the illegality and the danger of gun running.
But Scott Detrow, what about those other two senators, Rod Wright and Calderon? I mean, they took a leave of absence. So what's the difference between that and the suspensions that were voted on Friday?
Well, I think one thing you're seeing here is the cumulative effect. Roderick Wright is a different case than Yee and Calderon. Wright was convicted of basically lying about whether or not he lived in his Senate district. When you're talking about Calderon and Yee, you're talking about senators allegedly taking tens of thousands of dollars in bribes from undercover agents in exchange for official favors. And that's something that Daryl Steinberg and other Senate Democratic leaders have said it is a much different degree and much more serious allegation than what Wright has been convicted of.
And the vote on Friday was 28-1 in favor of suspending these three senators. San Diego Republican Joel Anderson was the only senator who voted no, and he wanted to see all three Democrats expelled from the Senate. Here's what he said.
So which is it today? More smoke and mirrors? More paid holidays?
That's right. And Calderon was initially knocked off of his committees before he went on paid leave in order to avoid being suspended. That was the point that Wright went on paid leave as well. The Democratic Senate leaders thought it was an issue of parity. If they're dealing with one person facing legal trouble, the other person facing legal trouble had to face the same punishment, they thought. Steinberg says he would love to expel Calderon and Yee. due to these bribery allegations. He asked them both to resign, but he says it wouldn't be fair to kick them out of the Senate before they've had their day in court.
And Daniel Newman from MapLight, of course, the most incendiary aspects of this are the gun running and all that. But there is also this garden variety bribery and taking money for favors. So what struck you about the details of those allegations against Leland Yee this week?
Well, you've got two scandals here. What's illegal, the allegations against Senator Yee. And then there's also the broader picture of what's legal and goes on every day in terms of influence buying. So in this case, Senator Yee is alleged to have taken $10,000 from a campaign contributor, this FBI undercover agent, in exchange for writing a letter to the state health department in favor of a contract that this contributor wanted. So that's illegal to say, I'll do this for you if you give me this money. But what's not illegal and what goes on every day is if you don't explicitly link those two and you're not caught on tape by the FBI. So, for example, if a state senator has someone come to a fundraiser, receives $10,000, and then 2 weeks later that contributor says, oh, by the way, there's this issue before the state health department, and if you were to do something about it, gosh, I'd really like that.
So it's just sort of unspoken or understood.
Exactly.
Yeah. And from what you've heard this week, I mean, does anything—we heard Daryl Steinberg talking about what could be done about this. Do you have any sense that this is going to sort of shock the legislature or the voters, for that matter, into doing something really fundamental here?
Well, the big picture is that Californians have a very poor opinion of the state legislature. So a PPIC poll this month, for example, only 36% of Californians approve of the job the legislature is doing. And that was before this new news came out. And so Steinberg and other lawmakers who were good-hearted and trying to do the right thing, of course, are concerned about that this is casting a pall on the whole institution. But the solutions I hear are focused pretty narrowly on, like, let's suspend this person or expel this person. It's the few bad apples idea. But really, it's a systemic problem that we create these transactional legislators because of the money that people need to get elected.
How would you say, as states go, California ranks? What's its reputation in terms of transparency, cleanliness in politics, corruption in politics? How do we stack up?
Well, it's a mixed bag in terms of transparency and campaign contributions published online. California's up there in the top third, perhaps. But that's other states have it better, like Arizona next door, where they have what's called clean election system. So you can get public funding to run your campaign. You don't have to raise money from big donors, and there aren't any donors to be on the hook to.
Scott Detrow, final question. This may or may not blow over between now and November, or other things may sort of transcend it. But what's the bottom line concern for Democrats going into November because of these three scandals?
I think the fact that three different lawmakers are facing different criminal problems and they're not related, I think that gives Republicans a pretty compelling argument to make to voters, saying, look, one party has had absolute control over Sacramento and look what's happened.
All right. Scott Detrow, Sacramento Bureau Chief, and Daniel Newman, President and Co-Founder of MapLight. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Procrastinators, take note. Monday is the last day to get health insurance without facing a possible penalty under the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. Covered California, the state's online health insurance marketplace, says more than 1 million Californians have already bought insurance, but some are waiting till the very last minute. At a clinic in San Francisco's Chinatown this week, a crush of people came in for help with their new coverage.
We have actually been very busy since the pre-enrollment started back in October. So, and our appointments are pretty much booked weeks in advance in terms of enrollment.
Christina Ng oversees Obamacare signups for a group of nonprofit clinics serving the San Francisco Bay Area's Asian community. Ng says most of the clients here don't speak English, and most come from working-class families.
We actually have many, many patients who are eager to apply, who are eager to enroll, because before they didn't have, they weren't able to afford insurance, they didn't have the opportunity.
But Ng says all that has changed with the Affordable Care Act. Now, people who qualify for subsidies can get help paying for private insurance, and more low-income Californians are eligible for Medi-Cal.
They do try to, if they're able to get coverage, just get the coverage and have coverage, and even, you know, they may be paying $80 a month or $100 a month, it's still better than having no coverage and paying the whole thing themselves.
So far, California has fallen far short of getting uninsured Latinos to sign up for insurance on the healthcare exchange. But Asian Americans are a different story. They represent nearly 23% of new enrollees, far more than their portion of the eligible pool. In a room off the main waiting room, clinic worker Judy Leung is helping Ivy Hong, mother of three children, sign up for private insurance.
This is her family's concern. In the United States, everyone has to have insurance. Otherwise, in case you don't have insurance when you're sick, then you have no access to care. And this is very important to have medical insurance.
Another big motivator, says Leung, avoiding that tax penalty. People who don't sign up for insurance by March 31st could have to pay a fine of up to 1% of their household income. There is a little wiggle room, however. The state now says that as long as people begin the application process by midnight Monday, they'll help them finish in time to avoid that penalty. San Diego County's Anza Borrego Desert State Park is famous for its amazing wildflowers. But this is the third year in a row of drier-than-usual weather at Anza Borrego, and wildflowers are scarce. As Lisa Morehouse reports, that's creating some anxiety and a few opportunities for those who live near and love California's biggest state park.
Hacienda del Sol, may I help you?
Kathy Gaffney and her husband Mike manage a hotel in Borrego Springs, a tiny town surrounded by Anza Borrego. There's one question prospective customers always ask.
How's the bloom?
The wildflower bloom.
Mike and I just kind of laugh about it. We dream about it. How's the bloom? That's the byword in Borrego in March.
This year, she tells them, there won't be one.
And they're kind of stunned. Until I say we have no rain. And sadly, no one can go out and water them and bring them around.
The last 3 years have seen the lowest number of visitors to Anza Borrego since the early 90s. The dry winters aren't the only reason the number of visitors has been way down. The recession hurt, too. But wildflowers are a big draw.
It will make or break a hotel. That's how important it is.
This year, the Gaffneys are seeing something a little different. Business is picking up despite the prospect of a barren bloom. Their hotel really stepped up their web and social media presence, and others are benefiting from a movie shoot. And people who really know and love this park are sending out the message that there's a lot more to do here than drive through the desert and look at wildflowers through car windows. Paige Rogowski runs the Anza Borrego Foundation, and she says she's targeting a different kind of visitor.
The people who are interested in what's underneath this rock, or how does this plant work here in the desert when it's so dry, or where can I find a bighorn sheep, and how do they live on the rocky slopes of the mountains?
Ranger Steve Beer loves answering questions like that. He's driving out of Borrego Springs past a spot where hikers recently discovered a mammoth tusk.
This whole area of the Badlands that we're driving into is known, probably one of the best examples of fossils from the Ice Age in the entire southwestern United States.
Beer's taking me out in the park just hours before the first major rain in months falls on Anza Borrego's desert-adapted plants.
You can feel them reaching out to the sky, going, please fall here. Give me a drop of water.
We drive unpaved roads to the base of a hill. With wind whipping around us, we walk up a sandy trail. Then Beer tells me to close my eyes and put my hand on his shoulder.
And hopefully here in another couple of feet, you'll get an idea of what a Badlands is. I'm going to grab your hand here. Keep walking forward. Now look up.
All I can say is, oh my God, We're at the edge of a cliff, the Vista del Malpais, looking over miles and miles of mud hills, sharp ridges, and deep channels formed over thousands of years by water and wind. There's not a vehicle or person in sight. Next, we drive down into these badlands to get to the Slot, a canyon whose walls rise 40 feet high. It's so narrow in spots, I have to squeeze through. Way above our heads, a block of rock the size of a school bus leans precariously from one side of the canyon to the other. Beer loves the solitude and great expanses of the park, and he says the upside to dry years is guiding visitors to sites like these.
There's so many directions this place can take. The wildflowers kind of take a back seat when you get totally immersed in Anza Borrego.
The next day, just north of Borrego Springs, Karen Vickers is training volunteers on how to lead plant walks.
Well, what I'm going to focus on is the group of plants that usually doesn't get any time as far as the public is concerned.
She points out a shrub with bright red flowers called chuparosa, and brittlebush and palo verde. Many of these plants are flowering a lot earlier than usual.
So, oh, I just love this plant.
Vickers wants people to use their senses with plants like this creosote.
This is another smell plant. Let's
to learn that the desert is living and blooming.
So what you do is you blow on it, and then you...
This is the smell of the desert.
Vickers' husband, Mac McNair, is another park volunteer. He says dry years allow people like him to help visitors connect more deeply with this desert.
We love the folks we get when times are tougher because they're not just out for like momentary eye candy and then back to L.A. or wherever, but they really want to get to know the place a little bit.
He's talking about people like Barbara Cossey, who's about to take a walk at Hellhole Canyon. She's here from Moss Beach, just south of San Francisco, and says she did have a pang of disappointment when she realized there'd be no wildflowers.
But for me, the interesting part is the habitat and even how it responds to drought.
She's seeing lots of other plants in bloom and reading about how, in an effort to survive drought, some plants will drop their seeds, creating a seed bank just waiting for the right conditions.
And so when the right conditions come, boom, then they'll bloom. So I'm happy to be here and to see the plants and knowing that they're waiting. You know, if they're not in bloom, they're waiting. And that's an important thing and maybe a lesson.
A lesson to be a little patient and look beyond the obvious. For the California Report, I'm Lisa Morehouse in Anza Borrego Desert State Park.
The University of California has six medical centers, and one of them, UC San Francisco, is about to undergo a major change. At the end of this month, UCSF Chancellor Susan Desmond-Hellmann is leaving to become CEO of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which has a major focus on global health. Desmond-Hellmann was an unconventional choice to head up UCSF. She came from the biotech company Genentech, where she directed the development of new drugs. I sat down with her this week, and I began by asking if she felt any particular challenge being the first female to head the university in its 150-year history.
On the front of being the first female chancellor, I had zero resistance and felt no pressure as the first woman chancellor. I felt that it was a much more odd thing for me to be from private industry. And so I did feel some pressure that individuals looked to me as potentially a drug company lady or someone from biotech, that they might be suspicious that I would value private industry over our public mission. But I think that was more odd than my gender.
UCSF is a nearly $4 billion enterprise, and it's also one of six medical schools in the University of California system. Davis, UCLA, Irvine, San Diego, most recently Riverside. What's the case for having so many medical schools in one state school system?
Well, it's a huge asset to the state of California, and the case for having so many medical schools is health is largely a local issue. Communities are really important when you're trying to drive health. Communities have different values. Communities have different ways of approaching things like exercise, diet, healthy behaviors. So having a local medical school that can serve that community and interact with that community is a positive. On the other hand, there's a coalition of all the UC medical centers and the medical schools called UC Health. And increasingly, UC Health is trying to drive the health of California.
We're in the midst of implementing healthcare reform in this country. There a chance that institutions like UCSF are going to really suffer because the whole model of fee-for-service and going to an expert to get something checked out, that's really being squeezed a bit with healthcare reform, isn't it?
Our leadership anticipated that we would, no matter what happened with the Affordable Care Act, we would need to lower our prices, we would need to focus on access, and we would need to change the way we operate from that fee-for-service to looking at safety, quality, affordability, very different for an academic medical center. But we need to do that while continuing to innovate, continuing to seek cures for diseases, and continuing to be leaders academically.
You're leaving UCSF to become the CEO of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation up in Washington, and they focus on global health, among other things. And there's been some concern expressed recently about rich guys like Bill Gates or Larry Ellison or Eric Schmidt down at Google spending a lot of money, hundreds of millions of dollars on research and health issues that they find to be important, and that in some way that could undermine sort of science for the common good. Do you have any concerns about, or what do you think of that criticism? Maybe is a better way to ask it.
Well, I'm a fan of public dialogue. I wouldn't have gone to a public university if I didn't embrace public dialogue. And as an innovator and as somebody who's participated in avenues of, for example, new cancer medicines, I found the engagement by breast cancer advocates frightening at first.
Noisy,
frightening, frankly, a little annoying. And my evolution as an innovator to embracing that and recognizing that that dialogue led us to better outcomes, I think the same is true with philanthropy. I am thrilled that Bill and Melinda Gates and Warren Buffett have decided to take their wealth and try and have all lives have equal value. I mean, that really resonates for me. I'm thrilled about that. Does that mean that no one should question or challenge the focus of the foundation or give input? Absolutely not. I would welcome that. Being in California, I think it's in our DNA to believe that healthy dialogue and debate brings better outcomes.
All right. Chancellor Susan Desmond-Hellmann, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And you can hear more of my interview with UCSF Chancellor Susan Desmond-Hellmann on KQED Newsroom on Channel 9. Trying to categorize Maclete Hedero's musical style is tough. The San Francisco singer-songwriter has been compared to artists as diverse as Joni Mitchell, Talking Heads, and Lou Reed. The California Report's pop music critic Steve Hockman says that on her new album, We Are Alive, she moves further beyond obvious comparisons and categories.
We Californians can be a bit superstitious when it comes to our state's faults. I mean the geological ones, not the other quirky characteristics. Not so much Maclete. On her new album, We Are Alive, the singer-songwriter and global activist confronts that fact of life head-on, even courts it. The set's opening song says it up front. We are, she sings, waiting for earthquakes.
Rocks of broken ground reveal the fissures when the sound reveals.
Of course, the song is metaphorical, about emotional tremblers, not the other kind. But upheaval is a current that runs through the album, both in lyrics and music. In other hands, her folky jazz might be smooth, easygoing. And with her rawly beautiful, nimble voice, she could certainly pull that off. But she never seems content with smooth. Just as you think you know what the music is, it becomes something else, even if just for an instant. A sudden dart or twist in a melody, as if a thought just popped into her head. a counter-rhythm pluck from bassist Sam Bevan, a spike of melancholic mystery from trumpeter Darren Johnston, a rumbling peal from drummer Lorca Hart. It's the sound of an artist not content to be any one thing, or even one thing at a time.
Rest me from this logic world, cave well house born. Slip me onto poetry, a million pages torn. Let the words wash over me, the words my soul will keep in sleep.
MacLeod was born in Ethiopia, raised in various spots around the U.S., and has been a San Francisco presence for the past dozen years. She's already a TED Senior Fellow for her work with music and culture of the Nile region and its diaspora. Producer Eli Cruz, who has worked with TuneYards, another global-minded shaker-upper, helps bring out all of MacLeod's experience and perspective in these songs. It's not world music per se, but there's a world of music here, with a dimensional quality only hinted at on her 2010 debut. Even when the music is delicate, as with the toy piano-based waltz Stuck on the Moon, there's a sturdiness to it, while the song Slow is simply exuberantly robust.
So give me all the clocks in your house. We can throw them, throw them. Give me all the clocks in your house. We can throw them, throw them. Take a second hand.
She also puts her stamp on two cover songs, which in the process serve as good reference points for her own material. There's a sort of Afro-jazz version of The Police's Shadowy Bring on the Night, followed by a traditional Ethiopian song, Kemakem. The latter, subtitled I Like Your Afro, features fellow Ethiopian Samuel Yerga guesting on piano. Where Waiting for Earthquake sets the tone, the title song, We Are Alive, ties it all together at the end. Now, she'd never be so trite as to say that we need earthquakes, emotional or otherwise, to make us feel alive. She's just saying, throw away those superstitions and enjoy the shake.
Steve Hockman is a Los Angeles-based writer who covers pop music for the California Report and KPCC. He reviewed We Are Alive by MacLeod. And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director is Susie Rocho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Danny Bringer and Howard Gelman. The online team includes David Weir, Lisa Pickoff-White, Olivia Allen Price, and David Marks. Dan Brecky was a contributing editor. Our interns are Kate Hunt and Matthew Levin. The California Report's editorial team includes Victoria Malione, Polly Stryker, Ingrid Becker, and Bruce Kuhn. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for coverage of California state parks are provided by the S.T. Bechtel Jr. Foundation. And funds for the California Report are provided by Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. The James Irvine Foundation, with nomination information about the 2015 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards, available at www.irvine.org. And the Wesley Foundation, improving the lives of California's children.